Oh, should we start this show?
Yeah, I'm down. Just buying a car on Carvana first.
Ooh, for real?
Yeah, it's super convenient. I already got pre-qualified in 2 minutes. All I had to do is answer a few questions.
Ooh, that's helpful.
And now just customizing my down and monthly payments.
Ooh, that's a very fair deal.
Yep. Boom. Just bought a car. And you get to take me to the Carvana vending machine in a couple days to pick it up.
Ooh. I'm kind of busy.
Visit Carvana.com to finance your next car.
Financing subject to credit approval.
Hi there, it's me, Claire Sanimal, host of Final Days on Earth. Thanks so much for tuning in and listening to this podcast that I've been working on for years. My great hope is that as many people as possible would hear Damien's story and that someone who knows something about his case will come forward with new information. If you want to help me do that, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to my show, and post about it on social media. These three things will really help expose Damien's story to a larger audience. And his family deserves that. If you have any thoughts or questions about Damien's case, I'd love to hear from you. Contact me securely by sending an email to tips@finaldaysonearth.com. Now, for this week's show. Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me for a special Q&A episode of Final Days on Earth. I'm your host, Claire Sanimal. For the past 7 weeks, we've been on a journey to discover what happened to Damien Hurd, and who, if anyone, is responsible for his death. This is my rookie podcast, and I so appreciate you hanging in there with me as I learn the ropes. And hopefully, the audio levels are getting better. Yes, I do read the reviews, and I appreciate every comment, the good, the bad, and the ugly, because it means I actually have an audience. And that in itself is exciting. You see, for years, Damien's story just lived in my head and on my computer, and there was no one I could really talk to about it because no one knew enough to have a real conversation. But that's all changed thanks to you, my loyal listeners. I thought I'd give you some numbers. This little podcast has been downloaded over 160,000 times with listeners in all 50 states and 99 countries. That's pretty cool. With an audience that wide, we've gotten some really interesting questions and observations from as close as Colorado and as far away as Australia. Several people have asked what happened to episode 4, and trust me, I feel your pain. For a long time, I couldn't find episode 4 either. It was an issue with Apple Podcasts, and it has been resolved. You should be able to listen to episode 4 on Apple Podcasts now, but if you're not able to, you can always find all the episodes at podcast1.com. Spoiler alert, if this is your first time listening to Final Days on Earth, you're going to want to hit pause and go catch up on episodes 1 through 7 before diving into this Q&A. All right, you've been duly warned, so let's get right down to it. Our first question comes from Krista, who lives in Gunnison, Colorado. Krista asks, are you 100% certain that it was Damien at City Market gas station? Was there any chance it could have been someone else? Just for context, the last known images of Damien's life are captured on video surveillance at a gas station in Gunnison, Colorado called City Market. The video was taken at 1:33 a.m. on Sunday, March 30th, 2014. It's about a 2-minute recording, and in it you see a black Saturn SUV reverse into position at the gas pump, and then you see a male exit the car and pump gas. Krista was the first person to ask this question, but a lot of other people have chimed in as well and are wondering, is that really Damien in the video? Could it be someone else? For this question, I thought I'd bring in Damien's dad, Gary Hurd. I think he's most qualified to answer with certainty about Damien's identity.
I'm confident that was Damien for sure.
And so what about that video made you believe that was 100% your son?
The way he walked would be one. His size, of course, would be another. It's kind of a grainy video, but, you know, the facial features don't match Damien's. I would definitely say I'm confident that was Damien pumping the fuel.
When I talked to Gary for this Q&A, he was on a break from work, and we talked over our cell phones. So the quality of our call is not perfect. I summarize what we say at times to avoid having to use the garbled recording. Several people notice that Damien backs into the pump, Whenever you watch the full video, you see he does not pull forward like you normally would to pump gas. He actually backs into it. I asked Gary if that struck him as odd. Gary said he wouldn't know if it was normal or not for Damien to back into a position at the pump. Gary considered the idea that something was blocking Damien from pulling forward, something out of view of the camera that we couldn't see.
The way he pulled in would have been the most difficult way to do it. So, and he seemed to do it pretty flawlessly. So, I don't have a good answer for that, to be honest.
No, I think that's a great answer, actually, because I noticed from it was, wow, I don't think I could do that stone cold sober, much less like
right.
At the end at 1:30 in the morning after a party with my friends. Like, man, that's some pretty sweet driving, dude. Like, I mean, I thought that was you know, expert level reverse maneuver. So that struck me in that way.
If you want to see for yourself, you can watch the whole video of Damien at the gas station on my website, finaldaysonearth.com/blog. The next part of Krista's question is about items found at the scene of Damien's death at Cabin Creek. Krista asked, did Damien have a sleeping bag and bandana like the ones at the scene? Yes, he did. The orange sleeping bag, the blue bandana, and the black and red jumper cables were items that belonged to Damien and that he was known to keep in his car. Here again is Damien's dad, Gary Hurt.
Before he went off to college, given where he was going and the climate there, I made sure that he had, you know, his emergency kit, which is where the jumper cables came from. And I made sure that he had a sleeping bag in case he ever broke down or anything like that up there. He'd have that. And the bandana, yes, that was his bandana.
Gary said that the bandana was something that Damien got in high school, and that other wrestlers on the high school team all had those bandanas and kept them on the rearview mirrors of their cars. I had spotted that bandana in many photos taken in Damien's car. Selfies and in other shots, you would see the bandana hanging somewhere in the car, often from the rearview mirror, but also sometimes it was in this area around the driver's side seatbelt hanging from the top. But in the scene photos, it was in a different location. It was actually found on the passenger seat next to the cell phone that was disassembled. There were four items on that passenger seat: the phone, its case, the battery, and the blue bandana. I asked Gary Hurd what he made of the bandana being in that location.
My gut tells me that's what they used to wipe the phone down, maybe even some of the controls on the vehicle with.
In case you didn't catch that, Gary said that his theory was that whoever harmed Damien used his bandana to wipe the phone down afterwards, and that's why there weren't any fingerprints found on it or anywhere else in the vehicle.
So yeah, my guess is, probably a really good guess, but that's what they used to wipe the phone and the car down with.
I had the same thought about it being used to wipe down the phone, because it doesn't make any sense to have it next to the phone and the battery. I mean, if you're taking apart a phone, and we know whoever did that, you know, more than likely used the tools that were in the car, because there was that screwdriver set that was mostly still packaged, you know, brand new down on the floorboard of the passenger seat. With some items that had been removed from it and were lying there as well. And then there was also the tool bag in the back seat that had various screwdrivers and things. So it looks like the tools, you know, to disassemble the cell phone were in that car. But why would you need a bandana? You don't need a bandana whenever you're using a screwdriver. You know, it got me thinking too, and it made me, especially when I found out there was one latent print on the face of Damien's cell phone, only one. I mean, my cell phone's gonna have tons of fingerprints on it. It seems like somebody, you know, once again, covering their tracks. And, you know, the question is it Damien covering his own tracks? Or is it someone who wished Damien harm, you know, covering their tracks? I think those are the two essential questions that we still, you know, are looking for an answer to.
Our next question comes from @JenDanity. Damien was seen at a gas station on closed-circuit television in the middle of the night after a party. Seems strange to be out driving around after a party, particularly when he was thought to be relatively intoxicated at the party that evening. Did he have a known history of going out driving after college parties? Seems more likely he would have been crashing at home or trying to meet up with a date, rather than driving around all alone after a party. when was he noted to be texting the girl to meet up? Great points, Jen. Let's take it one by one. First, Damien was not known to drive around after parties. Multiple people, including Kyle Pyatt and Devin Zavala, specifically told police that they did not understand why Damien would have left the house. Kyle said, whenever Damien drinks, he never wants to drive or do anything like that. And Devin said that when Damien partied hard, he would crash at the wrestler's house and sleep it off. To Jen's second point, there were multiple girls who were interested in meeting up with Damien after 1 a.m., and Western student Lacey Miller was in the process of going to Damien's dorm room at 1:30 in the morning when he stopped communicating with her, and it appears that his phone was turned off. It's definitely one of these stranger points in the timeline when Damien stops communicating with Lacey, fills his car with half a tank of gas, and disappears into the night at 1:36 a.m. Our next question comes from PumpK1251, who writes, "As a Gunnison local, I have been reading about Damien's case since 2014. I know many of the people in the podcast and all the locations, so it makes it even more interesting. I truly feel for Damien's family, and the lack of a thorough investigation would make Damien's death even harder to bear. My question is there any way to pressure the college into giving answers for why they lied and made multiple huge mistakes in reporting Damien present at class and the cafeteria on Monday?" Pump K, you are speaking my language. I have tried my darndest to get someone from Western Colorado University to go on the record with me. I've requested numerous interviews over the course of 7 years, but they've never been granted. In 2021, right before I launched this podcast, I contacted the university again to request an interview, and I also specifically asked about any university records that existed from March 31st through April 2nd, 2014. That pertained to the accuracy of information about Damien Hurd's ID card swipes and class attendance. I got a copy of an email timestamped at 8:44 a.m. on Wednesday, April 2nd. To put that in context, that's about an hour and 15 minutes before Damien's body is discovered by police. The email was sent from Gary Pearson, Vice President of Student Life, to University President Greg Salisbury and Executive Vice President Brad Baca. The email reads, "Greg and Brad, just a heads up for both of you. Damien Hurd, a freshman student from Fort Worth, Texas, and a member of the Western wrestling team, has been reported missing since late Saturday night, which has been confirmed as a last sighting. We are still waiting to get an official confirmation that he attended one of his classes on Monday, March 31st, 2014, and we do have documentation that his ID card was used in the Rare Air Cafe on Monday as well. Outside of those two situations on Monday, he hasn't been seen or heard from by any of his faculty, roommates, friends, or family. We are currently working with Damien's father and the Gunnison Police Department and are following our protocol for a missing student. You can scroll down the page to Missing Student and Policy Procedure. Please let me know if you have any questions or if you need additional information. Thank you." This language is notable to me because of how quickly the university backpedaled and tried to say that Damien was not in class or in the cafeteria Monday once his body was located and an eyewitness put him on scene Sunday afternoon. Note the difference between the next email that Gary Pearson sent out to the entire Western community at 3:42 p.m. that same day, April 2nd, 2014. "Dear campus community, I am deeply saddened to share with you that Western student Damien Hurd, a freshman, was found deceased on Bureau of Land Management property this afternoon in Gunnison County. Damien had not been heard from since early Sunday morning, and the university has been working around the clock with police to locate him. Police would like for you to know that they are not pursuing a suspect in Damien's death, and they do not believe anyone is at risk. Damien was a vibrant and beloved member of the campus community, a great student and an accomplished athlete. Our hearts and thoughts are with his family and friends." Did you catch that? The timeline just shifted. Damien's ID card usage in the Rare Air Cafe on Monday and his attendance in class is no longer a marker for the university. But as far as I can tell, the only thing that changed was the discovery of Damien's body. If they truly had an explanation, a glitch in the system, an error in looking up the information, why wouldn't they come out and say it? Their silence on the subject for 7 years speaks volumes to me. You can view both of these emails in their entirety on my website, finaldaysonearth.com/blog. It's me, Claire Santama, host of Final Days on Earth. When Simply Safe Home Security's founders, Chad and Eleanor Lawrence, designed their first security system in their kitchen, they did it for a very personal reason. Their friends had just had their home broken into. They were struggling to find a security system that was simple to set up and would make them feel safe again. Making people feel safe is what Simply Safe has been doing ever since that moment 15 years ago. A passion to protect people not only drives every engineering detail in its products, but it motivates every interaction with its customers. Simply Safe has highly trained security experts ready whenever you need them, whether that's during a fire, a burglary, a medical emergency, or even just when you're setting up the system. There's always someone there who has your back to keep you safe and make sure you feel safe. To learn more about how Simply Safe can help protect you and your family today, visit simplysafe.com/finaldays. To customize your system and get a free security camera, that's simplysafe.com/finaldays. Have you ever thought about how to take care of your family no matter where they go? An Air Medcare Network membership protects your family and your finances if a medical emergency arises. Air Medcare Network crews provide air medical transport to the nearest and most appropriate trauma center. And as a member, you'll never see a bill for that flight. It's true. Members never pay a thing for transport when flown by an AMCN provider. This is an important membership to have because your health insurance may not cover the full cost of emergency medical air transport. An AMCN membership covers everyone in your household for just pennies a day. And right now, my listeners get up to a $50 Amazon or Visa e-gift card when you join. Be prepared with an Air Medcare Network membership. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/final and use offer code FINAL. Do you ever get that feeling late at night that you're not really alone? When Simply Safe Home Security's founders, Chad and Eleanor Lawrence, designed their first home security system in their kitchen, they did it for a very personal reason. Their friends had just had their home broken into. They were struggling to find a security system that was simple to set up and would make them feel safe again. Making people feel safe is what Simply Safe has been doing ever since that moment 15 years ago. A passion to protect people not only drives every engineering detail in its products, but it motivates every interaction with its customers. Simply Safe has highly trained security experts ready whenever you need them, whether that's during a fire, a burglary, a medical emergency, or even just when you're setting up the system. There's always someone there who has your back to keep you safe. To learn more about how Simply Safe can help protect you and your family today, visit simplysafe.com/finaldays and customize your system and get a free security camera. That's simplysafe.com/finaldays. Let's go to our next question. I received a number of inquiries about the toxicology reports in Damien's case. C_Craven97 and several others have asked about why multiple toxicology reports were submitted in Damien's case and what were the differences between them. So this is an interesting and contentious element of Damien's story. I can confirm that yes, there were multiple toxicology reports in Damien's case. His body was found on April 2nd, and the first autopsy took place on April 3rd in Colorado. The second autopsy took place on April 10th in Texas. Toxicology samples were taken on both April 3rd and April 10th. In Colorado, the pathologist took a sample of Damien's blood that was sent to ChemTox Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. This lab tested for 16 different substances and returned 3 positive results, indicating the presence of cannabinoids, THC, and LSD. The second autopsy was conducted at American Forensics in Dallas, Texas. The pathologist there tested blood and vitreous eye fluid for 27 different substances. It all came back negative, except for chemicals used in the embalming process, which makes sense as Damien had already had his initial autopsy. What doesn't make sense is why Damien tested positive for LSD and marijuana in the Colorado lab, but negative in the Texas one. Here again is Damien's dad, Gary Hurt.
I'm definitely suspicious about the toxicology report showing a trace amount of LSD. We also sent out samples to an independent lab, and that test came back negative.
It's a very low level, 0.26 nanograms per milliliter, which is only 1/10 above the threshold for detection. The second autopsy, the one that showed no presence of LSD, was taken 1 week later. That's all I'll say for now, because in a future episode, I discuss the levels with two of the world's leading experts in the psychology and pharmacology of LSD. So you haven't heard the last on this subject. As I've mentioned before, this podcast isn't my full-time gig. I'm also a producer for the crime show 48 Hours on CBS. That means my Rolodex of detectives, investigators, and attorneys is pretty thick. Let's just say I know who to call no matter what side of a criminal investigation you end up on. One of those people I'm glad to have on speed dial is a former homicide detective for Lubbock Police Department, Zach Johnson. A skilled investigator, Detective Johnson also happens to be a fan of true crime podcasts. And the questions he was asking me about Damien's case were so good that I asked him if he'd come on the show as a special consulting detective for Final Days on Earth. After just a little bit of red tape, Lubbock PD signed off on it.
Thanks so much for coming on, Zach.
Oh, sure, Claire. My pleasure.
Detective Johnson is a 15-year law enforcement veteran.
So let's talk about, you know, how you and I know each other. I met you when I was working, you know, with 48 Hours, and you were
right.
A homicide detective on a really complicated murder-for-hire case out of Lubbock.
Yes.
That went to trial in 2015. Why don't you tell us who the victim was and who went on trial?
The victim was a very well-known and well-respected doctor here in Lubbock, Dr. Saunier. And the suspect who hired a gunman to kill him is named Mike Dixon. He's a former plastic surgeon out of Amarillo, Texas.
Yes, and if we talked about that case, we would have a whole nother podcast on our hands, wouldn't we, Zach?
Yes, we would. It would be gigantic.
We'll leave it there, and any listeners who are interested can look up that case. They have all the specifics now, and it's something else. But that's how you and I met, and we stayed in touch since the podcast came out, and you know, we started discussing Damien's case each week, and I really liked the questions that you were asking me, and I just want to make sure everyone knows you're not affiliated with this case or with the Gunnison Police Department, and you're just doing this as an independent consulting detective for Final Days on Earth.
Yes, correct.
Great. So you had some interesting observations and questions that had popped into your head after listening to, I believe it was the fourth episode. The body.
Yes. Yes.
Body of evidence. So I just wanted to see if you would take me through your questions and we could discuss them.
The first question that came to my mind was I remembered that he was last seen wearing diamond earrings in particular and a jacket. And when they found him, it was not clear if those items were there. So that was my first question. Was okay, so if he has diamond earrings, those are relatively expensive, and they possibly could lend themselves to a motive. So where did those end up? Do we know, were they ever accounted for?
Excellent question, and the fact is, we do not know where those earrings are. They've never been accounted for. They've never been found. They were not on his body whenever it was cut down from the tree at Cabin Creek. They were not in the car. It was thoroughly checked, and no one has ever come forward with them. The police did not execute any search warrants on the house or on any of the wrestlers' vehicles or any of Damien's friends' vehicles, so we don't know where those earrings could have ended up, but they've never been found, and that is something that I have always wondered about as well. And the blue jacket that he was seen wearing, that he had Snapchatted with the night of the party, people saw him in that coat, his roommate saw him leave the dorm wearing that coat. It's also never been found, and you know, he was found in different clothing He was found in a sweatshirt that belonged to Andrew Morris. That was not Damien's. That's what he
right.
was. So I have had those same questions and have been so curious. The only clarity I ever got on the earrings, just as far as what they really were, there was actually a receipt in his car. One of the items that the police, cataloged whenever they went through everything in his car was a receipt for those earrings, and they were cubic zirconia. But they looked so real. I mean, and they were very flashy, and he had just gotten them a couple weeks earlier. So they were a new purchase, still had the receipt in his car, and had just recently started wearing them. Like his new signature look, right? And every photo
right.
that's taken after the purchase of those earrings, he's wearing them. Very recognizable. So I'm curious to this day, what happened to them.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that would be very interesting to know, for sure.
Let's go to your next question.
Okay. Well, I can remember there was the subject of the battery in the cell phone, and that the battery had been taken out. It made sense to me, if you remove a battery from a cell phone, you don't want anybody to know where that cell phone is. And so you take the battery out, which kills the power, which kills the ability to track that phone, right?
Yes.
So that would make sense to me if somebody didn't want anybody to find that phone, being that the phone is going to be on that person. The other question that comes to mind is the SIM card in the phone. Traditionally, if you remove a SIM card, you don't want people to know what's on the phone. So you take the battery out so you don't know where the phone has been and where it is, and you take that SIM card out so people don't know what's been on the phone. My biggest question was, I know the battery was missing. Was it ever recovered? If it was it in the immediate area? Was it in the car? Or is it a possibility that it was tossed out somewhere else? And was the SIM card in the phone when they recovered the phone?
Great questions. So the battery was found lying right next to the phone on the seat of the car,
okay.
The passenger seat of the car. So let me just paint the picture for you. The phone has been disassembled. There's a case that was on it. The case is off. It's also on the passenger seat. The phone itself is on the passenger seat. The battery is removed, and it's lying. All three items are lying, next to each other. Just sort of like they've been dropped, not specially arranged or anything, but just like they took it apart, and that's just the position they fell in. And then
right.
there's also this blue bandana, and it's lying on the seat, or in and around those items. It's kind of wrapped up around those items. They're touching.
Okay.
And then at the bottom of the floorboard of the passenger seat, there is a screwdriver set that is mostly still packaged. It's obviously somewhat new.
Right.
There's some items removed from it. It's been opened, but it's recently been purchased, and the packaging is still there, and it's in the floorboard of the passenger side of the car. I found all of that so curious and such
right.
a scene, right? Because someone,
right.
it would appear that someone purposefully went out and purchased these tools to open this cell phone. Damien disappeared at 1:30 in the morning. This is a very small town. I do not think there are stores that are open at 1:30
right.
in the morning that sell these items. Possibly, right? Could be. But
right.
there's no other activity on his debit card. There's no cash found in his wallet, so you could say possibly he used cash to purchase, a screwdriver set, but it's never been accounted for. It was my understanding, it was not fingerprinted. It was not, DNA swabbed. There was no, it's not known where that screwdriver set came from and who used it. Damien's friends and his family, they said that he was not like a techie guy. Like, I mean,
mm-hmm.
if my husband has disassembled, all the computers, all the cell phones, all the electronics in our house, messed with, motherboards. Like, if there was a screwdriver set in his car, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Like,
right.
he does that
right.
kind of stuff, right? He builds
right.
computers. Damien did not do that. And so his friends and his family, the idea that his cell phone was, like, I don't want to say professionally disassembled, but it was deliberately disassembled with the proper tools was strange to them. You know, if Damien was going to do something to his phone, it'd be like throw it on the ground. You know, just it seemed out of character for him. Now, granted,
right.
A lot of this behavior seems out of character for him. So,
right,
you know, take
right.
all that with a grain of salt. But I just thought it was interesting that he was not a tech-savvy guy who disassembled electronics normally, right?
Right.
So that was interesting. The SIM card was still inside the phone. What appears to have happened is that at some point someone went in and deleted communications that occurred the night of the party. The very text message that Damien sent Anthony Rios, the cross-country runner, to invite him to the house was not on Damien's phone. The threat did not exist. Anthony was a contact in his phone, but they had no message history. And whenever Anthony came to the police department and brought his phone, he showed them the text message on his phone. The thread was there. It was from Damien Hurd's cell phone. It was not in a separate app. It was a text message. And Anthony still had it on his phone, but Damien didn't have it on his. And there's no record of it. So that's always been very curious. There's other messages. For example, one that sticks out in my mind, Gary Hurd messaged his son, you know, on Facebook whenever his phone was dead. He couldn't get through, you know, if the phone's turned off, you know, you don't see a missed call, right? Because the phone's turned off. So we couldn't see that, but he was so desperate that he went ahead and sent him a Facebook message. And the Facebook message that he sent just, you know, said, "Hey, I've been trying to get a hold of you. You know, let me know that you're okay." And he sent that on Monday, okay, because that's that Facebook message, whenever
it's
Gary,
gone.
It's gone. So whenever Gary got into Damien's Facebook account and went into his Messenger app, there's not a message from his dad. And that would have been the first and only message he ever sent him.
That's important as well, the timeline.
Absolutely.
Very
and
important. Yeah.
Between you and me, I mean, and, you know, and everybody listening, one of the things I found most surprising in this investigation is that the police did not do a timeline. There is no timeline. If they did a timeline, it is not in their 187-page police report.
Wow.
And I feel like that would be part of the report.
Right.
They did not put a timeline in there, and, you know, as you know, they would not grant me an interview, so was not able to ask them if they did a timeline, you know, that was written. But I asked for all reports, documentations, you know, any written audio, video recordings that existed, you know, in the course of this investigation. I was never given a timeline, and so I created one. You know, that was really main thing that I did in this podcast is central to everything, was creating this timeline. And then deciding, you know, how to break it up into episodes and talk about things piece by piece. But without the timeline, I have no investigation. I have no story.
Right.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, exactly. And between the timeline and a really solid victimology of him, you know, it's really going to be very confusing and very complex. And so I think those are the two most important things that you can do. Is a victimology and a timeline to kind of set everything up front and try to clear it up.
I agree. And for people who don't know, can you explain what a victimology is?
Sure. So victimology is a study of the person, the victim, and what about their activities or their life led to them being a victim. In other words, you've got this particular case. There is a ruling of suicide in the case. So the question would be, okay, we have a suicide here. What about the victim or his life led him to committing suicide? And we would investigate that to try to determine what happened in this man's life to lead him down the path to committing suicide. If there was not a suicide finding and if there was a suspicious death finding, then the question, of course, would be, what about his life, especially in the final days of his life and the hours, what about that led him to becoming a victim of foul play? And so it's the timeline plays an important, very important role in that, because that is going to help set up the events that lead to the death, be it suicide or a suspicious death. And I think that the biggest hurdle in the investigation, especially now we're sitting in 2021, I think the biggest hurdle in that investigation is the fact that you have two medical examiners, one being independent, ruling that it's a suicide. I say that only because it's very, very challenging to get past a medical examiner's ruling as an investigator, and also if you go down the road further as a court.
Yeah.
And so when I'm presented with medical examiner's findings of, well, sir, this is a suicide, then my death investigation pretty much hits a road. It stops.
Yeah.
Because there is no suspicious death anymore. It's ruled a suicide. And on top of that, you have what appears to be self-strangulation by hanging with the battery cables.
Yeah.
In a place that is way out where nobody can find you, with a cell phone that has no battery, to where the whole thing says, I don't want to be found. I want to be left alone. And I want to do this. And no one is going to convince me otherwise. Now, that's all well and good. If, and here's the big if the other questions never came up, such as the vehicle that was seen over there with his vehicle,
yes,
the pickup truck with the camper shell. If there was not these emails from professors talking about a timeline here,
yeah,
that said, we saw him in class on this particular day, and then they have the code not only typed into class, but it's typed in at the cafeteria. So the big, and that raises the question, okay, well, if that is legit, then, you know, who did that? Because you'd have to know that personal number from what I gathered about,
yes,
what everyone said.
Or have his card.
Or have his card, which we know his card was on his person when the body was found.
Right.
Right. And the card was broken. So the question becomes, okay, well, you said that the university says we got email confirmation that he was there. Okay, well, who are the professors? Let me bring them in, get them on the record so that I know for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the young man was in class on this day at this time. And I know that. I can back that up because his professor visually saw him in that class. And then I can further back that up by his key punch into the class. And then I know that they got that other kid on the record about seeing him at lunch. And then, you know, somehow getting that key punch on the record as well. But then you have all of that, but then the school comes back and says, well, maybe not. You know, I mean, and that's extremely frustrating because now they've changed their story. And is it truly a mistake? Was it truly, did they truly misspeak? And if so, why? Why would they say something like that? Because that's a pretty heavy statement. Well, yeah, we know he was there because we got email confirmation. Okay, well, why are you so concerned about backing that up with an email? You know, so those are big questions that without those questions, I think that it would be a smooth suicide investigation. But you've got these other questions that have popped up.
At this point, Detective Johnson brought up the statement from hiker Linda Nienhauser, who called Gunnison police the day Damien's body was found to report her sighting of Damien and two vehicles at Cabin Creek.
And why do we have a witness that comes forward and provides all this information and then recants? What's the motive for that? Because, you know, I don't know. She said she was confused. But, you know, I mean, she gave a pretty lengthy description, from what I remember. A very vivid description. So vivid that they were able to connect that vehicle possibly to the wrestler who just so happened to have a fight, a physical fight with him the night that he disappeared.
Yes.
Right. And so that plays into your victimology as well. What about his actions put him into a place that led to his death? Well, he had a fight with another guy. There is some question as to whether that guy strangled him at the party or not. It wasn't so severe that he couldn't, you know, leave, debilitating that he couldn't leave. But, you know, that goes to show a motive of sorts. And then, oh, and by the way, we have a witness that came forward, independent witness that came forward that said this vehicle was there. By the way, matches the general description of this dude's vehicle, or the parents' vehicle, rather, that he has access to, right? So where is that vehicle? You know, we need to lay hands on that vehicle. We need to take, at the very least, take pictures of it, see if it truly matches the description from the witness.
Yeah, they could have taken a picture of that car. It was still parked out in front of the wrestler's house and in that alley, and they could have shown that picture to Linda and said, is this the car you saw? They did not do that.
Right. So it's complex.
Detective Johnson's next question was about the condition of Damien's body when the police discovered it.
About how long did they feel that his body had been outside there? Had it been affected by any of the elements outside? Did they have a timeline to see how long, or they believed how long the body had actually been there? And that type of thing.
Yes. So excellent questions. You know, the medical examiner's report, does not list an estimated date of death. They say the body was found on April 2nd, and that's listed as his official date of death. And they make a note in their report that a witness saw the body, on Sunday, March 30th, but they do not attempt to determine how long his body had been out there through, you know, forensic means. They do not, you know, examine the contents of his stomach. I have seen that in many other homicide cases where the time of death is a question. You know, I've seen where they go in, they look what's in the stomach, they can tell how long it's been digested and how long the person, presumably within a range of time, when they were last alive. They didn't do that in this case. And they didn't, you know, take a body temperature. Now, granted, he was outside and it's Colorado, but I've seen, you know, research and literature that talks about accounting for the outside temperature and amount of time and still a way to get a range of when this body stopped breathing, when the blood stopped pumping. And none of those things were done. And unfortunately, you know, the contents of the stomach are gone now. The body temperature is gone now. We won't know those things. And so, I mean, there's the autopsy photos. You know, you can see lividity and you can see blanching. So, you know, we know that he had been, and the body was, you know, rigor mortis had set in. It was stiff. He had been there for a while, you know. But we don't have any type of real definitive time or date of death. Really, just not even a date of death. We really don't know if it was, you know, we know after 1:30 a.m. he leaves that gas station, and that's the last time we really know that he's alive, is 1:36 a.m. on Sunday, March 30th, 2014. And then his body is seen by Linda Nienhauser. She estimates sometime, she arrives around 10 a.m., and she leaves, she thinks, around 1:30 or 2 p.m. on Sunday, March 30th. So we have this, you know, 10 to 12 hour range of time where we don't know where Damien Hurd is, and we don't know if he's dead or alive between 1:30 a.m. and 10 a.m., you know, to 1:30 p.m. when Linda has her hike.
You just never know. And See, the biggest challenge, especially now that we're 6-7 years on in this thing, the biggest challenge, let's say there comes new evidence and, oh my gosh, we need to reopen this thing because here's some new information that blows this case wide open, right?
Right.
Well, the biggest challenge is going to be getting past those ME rulings, because not only do you have one, but you got an independent one hired by the family.
Yeah.
That said, it's suicide. So a court is going to be very hard pressed to grant search warrants on a case that was ruled a suicide, because their first question is going to be, well, why do you want to search this man's phone history?
Yeah.
Because the question to me would be, okay, let's say you have a person of interest in the case. Well, how can we put him at the scene of the crime? Well, you track his cell tower records.
Right.
Right. But you've got to go through a court because you got to get a warrant for that.
So can you still get... I thought you couldn't get cell phone records now that it's been 7 years, because they didn't do it at the time. They didn't subpoena the records. They didn't do the cell phone towers. Can you still get those 7 years later, the tower information?
It may be possible, depending on who had the towers at that time and if they still have the towers.
Wow.
Because a lot of cell phone companies share those towers.
That's so interesting, because I honestly thought that had all been long gone, that those were, you know, that I thought like 6 months or something, and those towers would be, you know, their data would be deleted, you know, just for more space or something, like if the cops don't come calling, you just, you know, it's not pertinent to keep.
Well, it's always worth a shot. It's always worth a simple question. Hey, if I submit a warrant, would I be able to get tower information from 2014?
Oh my gosh.
And they're going to tell you either yes, or they're going to tell you no, man, that's gone.
Yeah.
It's been too long. It's gone.
What I wouldn't give to know if that data is available.
Right. Because then you can kind of put some puzzle pieces together. If you can, depending on what you find out, of course, is going to shoot it off in any number of directions.
Yeah.
But it sure does give you more questions to ask. But yeah, it's very complex, and there are so many wild cards. There are so many just weird things that pop up that seem to contradict each other.
I totally agree. What would you think of the oxygen deprivation mask?
See, and that was my other question, or that was a question that came into my mind. So, strangulation in a homicide, one of the almost universal findings is a hyoid bone fracture.
Yes.
Right? Because of the force that's exerted when you strangle somebody with your hands or when you strangle them with the ligature. And that fracture severs the windpipe, the trachea, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, we have an asphyxiation that didn't crack the hyoid bone, that didn't fracture it, but that was enough to kill somebody, right? And we're guessing that it is because of these battery cables. So the question is, okay, so is it a traumatic, if it's not traumatic asphyxiation, you know, how far did, where was he at? Like what distance or level was he at? How high off the ground was he when he jumped?
He didn't jump. Yeah. In this case,
did he bend forward?
Yeah, that's what he did. His toes were touching the ground. He's leaning against a rock. You know, if we're going with the theory of suicide, then he did it himself. It's a slow, controlled process. The sleeping bag is laid out over the rock that his body's leaning against. His toes, both toes, are making contact with the ground, and it would appear that he, you know, slowly deprived himself of oxygen until he died.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and yeah, because the other thing that's going to give you that finding is probably the oxygen deprivation mask.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I hope you enjoyed this Q&A episode as much as I did. And tune in next week for the next installment on the life and death of Damien Hirt. Thanks so much for listening. Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One and Live by Live. Each episode is written, reported, and produced by me, Claire Sanimal. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Songs licensed from premiumbeat.com are Bending Truth and A Thin Line. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of lucymedia.com. Additional production help from Amber Robinson, Janice Sue, and Elise Weber. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Gary Hurd and Zach Johnson from the Lubbock Police Department for talking to me in this episode.